Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Every team, every topic, everywhere, this is Believe.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Only Podcast. I am your co-host, Austin Smith, joined as always by your other co-host, John Kirby. Let's see here. You can find us on Twitter at ACSmith06 and at John_Kirby. And as always, follow the mothership at Believe Network. Today is Wednesday, December 20th, just before Christmas. And guys, listen up. All the major sports are in action this week. College football playoffs ready to start. And guess what? BetOnline is your number one destination for all your sports wagering info, news for pro football, the NBA, upcoming fights, and the NHL this season. Head to the website today to get into the action and see all the updated odds for the week. Remember to use promo code BELIEVE, that's B-L-E-A-V, to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet online where the game starts. Was earlier last week, maybe last week, John, where the basketball season starts?
Yeah.
We will get to that in due time, but guess what has not started? The football season. The off season is well underway, though. That's one of the worst intros I've ever done.
I kind of liked it.
Okay.
It was a good preview for what we're going to do today.
So. I appreciate the support, as always.
In case you didn't know, yeah, we're going to talk about basketball and football.
Yep.
For Michigan State.
Really going to spice this up this week. Go out on a limb here. Try something new. Well, guess what, guys? It's, like we said, the football off season. Since we last saw you or spoke to you, in case you're staring at your stale graphic on your phone right now, maybe you're seeing us, I guess. Two new coordinators, position coaches for Michigan State. One familiar, one, I guess, technically somewhat familiar. John?
Yeah.
Well?
Let's see. Let's start with Courtney Hawkins, wide receiver, position coach. Unarguably, probably the best position coach of the Mel Tucker era, considering the outputs that you see on Sundays and soon to be Sundays of Keon Coleman. So, and Jaron Glover getting a Georgia official recruiting visit. That's Courtney Hawkins' joint, man. That's Courtney Hawkins.
Yeah, kind of wild that Jaron Glover is, yeah. I thought he was good, but Georgia's not messing around. So, yeah, maybe even another feather in Hawks' cap. We kind of talked about him a little bit last time because this wasn't unexpected. It was very much on the table. But it's exciting for Michigan State. I think it says a lot about what he brings to the table, potentially a lot about his relationship with Nick Marsh, who is the highest-ranked recruit. I think we talked about this last time coming in. Top 100 roughly-ish kid who decommitted and then recommitted to Michigan State and has stayed committed and will sign in the early signing period today if you're listening to this on Wednesday. So huge testament to Hawk. Exciting to see what he's done, like you said, with young talent. He did a lot with Montori Foster, taking a step ahead this year. He's brought in some exciting young players who unfortunately have transferred away, some of them, but guy clearly has an eye for talent. And I think it was probably a smart move to keep some level of stability and at least one familiar face in the building if you're Jonathan Smith.
Yeah, got to do it for the culture too. Like,
that's right.
I'm really happy that Jonathan Smith is a big boy enough coach to understand that you don't just walk into any program really at this level and just kind of say, this is how I'm going to do things. Mm-hmm. Like there are things that are done a certain way at programs. And you have to acknowledge that. And hopefully you become a part of that fabric, you know, with your wrinkle on it. So I think it was a really good idea for him. He's also a liaison to the entire MSU football community that has graduated and moved on or is at different levels, right? So you want that. You want to be able to have also recruits be able to talk to Jaden Reed during recruiting visits, right? And does that happen if Courtney Hawkins doesn't reach out and ask, for those guys to do that favor? I don't know. Maybe. But it becomes an easier conversation, right? So I think it was a great hire.
Yeah, it was smart. I was thrilled to see it. Like you said, consistency, ability to tap into some recent NFL success, all really just smart move. Another seemingly great step in the right direction from Jonathan Smith. The next is interesting, but I think good. And that's the much anticipated hire of a defensive coordinator. The choice was Joe Rossi. Now, Joe Rossi is familiar to some corners of the Big Ten already. He's been Minnesota's defensive coordinator for the past, I think, 6 or 7 years. I was hired in 2019, I believe. Mm-hmm. 2018. So the past, John, 6 seasons.
Maybe it was.
And you hear, like, at first blush, you hear Minnesota defensive coordinator, and it doesn't seem great. because, hey, Big Ten West, what kind of offenses is he really facing? And while those concerns are fair, and we'll talk about them, there's no denying the statistical success that Minnesota had over his tenure. Just going to read off some stats here. He was the defensive coordinator and linebackers coach. And he had, in the last 6 years, 3 separate times where Minnesota's defense ranked in the top 10 in the FBS in total defense, and twice they ranked in the top 6 in scoring defense. I mean, that, listen, he's coached 30 all Big Ten honorees, 2 first team All Americans, 10 NFL draft picks. The Gophers went 40-22 in his 62 games as a defensive coordinator. It's impressive. There's no getting around just the statistically impressive nature of his resume. He runs kind of a bit of a not super unfamiliar scheme to Michigan State fans in terms of like formation wise. The way that he deploys his players is seemingly quite a bit different, but it's kind of this hybrid, just call it a front 7 look, where there's typically 3 kind of down linemen, sometimes, like a Jacoby Windman, who can cycle back between pass rusher standing up, pass rusher with his hands down. There can be 2 linebackers, 3 linebackers, sometimes, 5 down linemen. It's a little bit of everything. So I think from a system perspective, it's a modern defense. It's one that he's deployed aggressively and successfully over the last 6 years within the Big Ten. So there's something to be said for that. I think, to be totally fair, though, and say both sides, it's fair to look at the competition that Minnesota's had and kind of ask some questions as to what's going to happen when he plays against the big boys and he's not sheltered by the Big Ten West. John, what do you think?
It's like a weighted score, right? Like, you're the top 10 in the country and you're in the Big Ten West. Okay. It's probably more like a top 30, right? So that's good. Right. Like, even if we're waiting average here about how bad the Big Ten and West offenses were, there's no denying that they were still quite competent. So when they did venture outside the sheltered Big Ten West, there were some hiccups. And that's going to be where a lot of the question marks lie. I do want to know. Minnesota is, as a football program, forever screwed. Like, they're so lucky they're in the Big Ten. And I mean that because they're in a professional sports town. So they're fifth fiddle. And Minnesota is not a football state. It's a hockey state. So there really just isn't a ton of talent there, right? And imagine, and then you look around at the states that surround it. Wisconsin, there's a school that kind of owns Wisconsin, and it's the Wisconsin Badgers. Then you've got to the west, North Dakota and South Dakota. And candidly, like, there are 4 pretty good programs in the Dakotas, and you're kind of like recruiting against them. And That's also the type of caliber kid there is, because if those kids were good enough, they wouldn't be at those schools.
Well, the thing is, too, is like those guys, like players can go play there. Yes, it's in a lower division, but those teams are consistently competing for championships.
Yeah, whereas, that's sure.
You know, you go to Minnesota and like you're saying, it makes it even more difficult because with those same guys, you're not competing for championships in the Big Ten.
Yeah, it's my whole point is so the talent level there, it's like so hard to get someone to come to that school because of the reasons we just outlined. So I just wonder, you know, has Michigan State become an easier place for him to recruit? Also, you know, depending on the kids he did get, you know, how good of a recruiter were you that you got them there? I don't know, you know, to be determined. It's certainly an easier sell for him to get guys in East Lansing. So that's kind of the key here, right? I mean, you gotta get top tier talent and, you know, obviously develop, and that's what we rely on. But in all honesty, we're not sure where he lands quite yet, but.
Yeah. Well, I think your assessment there is spot on, which I honestly do think makes what he did even more impressive. But there's a specific part of it that I think in particular is really impressive, and that's the amount of guys he was able to put into the NFL, but specifically defensive backs. And we've had some rough times with defensive backs in the last handful of years, sure, since the heyday of, you know, Darquez Dennard and Trey Waynes and that era. It feels like we've kind of been cycling through defensive backs ever since. In his 6 years, Rossi was able to put a handful of defensive backs into the NFL, including two just last year, chosen the two fifth round picks chosen in the 2023 draft, Jordan Howden and Terrell Smith. You may know Antoine Winfield Jr. Was a first team All-American selected in the second round by Tampa Bay back in 2020. Same year, he had another defensive back, Chris Williamson, selected in the seventh round by the Jets. And this year, he's got an All-American in Tyler Newbin, who will probably be late first to third round pick. I mean, that's six guys in the last 4 years that he's put in the NFL from Minnesota as defensive backs. That's nothing to sneeze at. He also put Boye Mafe, the defensive end for Seattle, who's having a really nice season this year for the Seahawks. He got him drafted in the second round. The theme here is the same theme with Jonathan Smith and the coaches he's brought with him, and that's taking talent that may not be super highly rated out of high school, developing it and having success across a period of time, and ultimately putting those guys into the NFL. As a theme across a football program, it is exactly the tenor Michigan State should be striking. That is exactly how they need to be building this program. That's how they have to operate. There's no other way around it. It's how the best programs in the country operate, and Michigan State absolutely must do things that way because they don't have the margin for error that the Georgias and the Bamas and the, you know, the Michigans, quite honestly, they don't have that margin of error to say we're going to get top, you know, 1 to 10 to 15 classes every single year, so we can miss on a couple more development guys. We're not going to have to do as much. They're going to get something in the 20 to 30 range, which is going to require a greater level of coaching and development, and they're built for that. And every hire they've made has been with that in mind. And a lot of the recruits that they've brought in so far, you can see kind of fit in the mold of, you know, that physical profile that's really not that much different than the archetype that, again, Mel Tucker was kind of going for. There just seems to be a little bit tighter grasp on it, and it's more maybe substance than flash, which is, I think, what we got a lot of with that era of Michigan State football.
Yeah. Upon reflection, you know, in hindsight is 2020, Mel Tucker was building something that he'd never coached before. Mm-hmm. Whereas a guy like Jonathan Smith is coaching the same exact type of thing, just at a higher level. And those are two very different things. And there's nothing wrong with having the vision that Mel Tucker had. I think it's just more difficult to realize than to just carry your way of doing things from one level up to the next level. So just a thought. And overall, I think the hire, like all, you know, are to be determined. There's a lot of question marks, but it doesn't feel like a question marks in like a, oh my God, what's going to happen way. Just more of a, well, you kind of have to trust the guy and
absolutely
see how it goes. Right. He has earned the benefit of the doubt from his experience and resume. And so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I think he's not only earned it from what he did at Oregon State, which should have been more than enough, but the action and the way that he's gone about putting his staff together, the way that he's approached recruiting, and quite frankly, the early returns on his recruiting here have to give you even more faith if you're a Michigan State fan, because there was some portal turnover. No question about it. Quite a few guys have entered. But realistically, if you're looking at I don't know how you can look at anybody on this team and say, okay, well, you know, we're devastated to lose that player. It was a 4-8 team with no like true individual standout players on either side of the ball. Like truly, like that is just flat. That's just the truth. There are some guys you hate losing more than others, but realistically, you can't look at it any other way than inevitability. And like some of these guys were always going to go. You lose a coach, guys are going to leave. But the four transfers that Jonathan Smith had brought in, again, kind of match what we've been talking about. Since we last talked, the biggest fish that he brought over with him is Aiden Chiles.
I think we talked about it last time.
Oh, did we?
I don't remember, but that happened first, I think, right?
It's worth talking about again because that's incredibly exciting. Like, I think we did talk about this, where Chiles is a top 60 recruit that Jonathan Smith got to follow him to Oregon State. And he believes in him so much that he's went out of his way to make sure that he came with him instead of trying to go get DJU, by the way, who he also recruited to come to Oregon State from Clemson to salvage his career. Rather than pursuing him, he pursued who could have been honestly like seen as the safer option as like a stopgap quarterback. Like DJU started for 3 years now in his college career, probably wanted to shoot higher than Michigan State, but for all intents and purposes, Michigan State chose to pursue Chiles and his upside over DJU. I think that says a lot. Since then, Smith also prioritized getting one of Chiles' favorite targets and one of Oregon State's favorite targets last year, and Jack Velling, the tight end. I believe he's a senior, had 8 touchdown receiving touchdowns, 29 catches last year. Big body dude. He's ranked as a 4-star transfer by 24/7. Yeah, checks in at 6'4", 241 from the Seattle area. He was a 2021 recruit, so he may actually have 2 years of eligibility left, but a really exciting follow. Again, a testament to the offense and the program that he built there. Two other guys came along, TJ Sheffield, who, again, fans of the Big Ten West will remember from Purdue. He's never been a super standout at Purdue, but he has 1 year of eligibility left. And is kind of profiles more along the lines of like a Trey Mosley type. He had 32 catches for 381 yards and 2 touchdowns this year, 46 catches for 480 and 4 a year before that, 36 catches for 325 and 1 a year before that. So he's played quite a bit of football, fairly reliable. Don't expect anything too crazy in terms of production, but just getting another solid upperclassman set of hands who can be a part of the rotation, given the fact that Tyrell Henry entered the portal, Jaron Glover entered the portal, Christian Fitzpatrick entered the portal. The fact that those three are in means there's catches to go around. Sheffield is a solid choice to be one of the guys to do that, fill that role. The final one is Jordan Turner. Again, Big Ten West theme here. Jordan Turner coming over from Wisconsin. Originally from Farmington, Michigan, so went to Farmington High, coming over for his grad year. So his final year of eligibility. He's been an all Big Ten honorable mention before, which is, you know, a guy who's been a starting quality player for a program that's had some great defenses recently in Wisconsin. Kind of that senior leader adding to that linebacker room. Pretty athletic guy. I think the theme here with Chiles aside is it's three of these four are upper class kind of immediate contributors. So Smith is utilizing the portal in the way that it really should be utilized, not to fill out a roster, but to kind of come up with some stopgaps, some reliable guys that raise the floor of your program. I think Sheffield, Velling, and Turner all do that. And then Chiles is really the big grand slam addition who, you know, should be considered the odds on favorite. It would be kind of shocking if he wasn't the starting quarterback week one for Michigan State next fall.
Yeah. And, you know, they're still in the hunt for other quarterbacks, but it just becomes such a hard sell. I mean, if they pull it off, I have my doubts, but Tyler Cherry, a four-star quarterback from Indiana, is, you know, still on the board between Indiana and Michigan State, actually. They made a really good hire. We've talked about it in Indiana. I think
Kurt Cignetti.
Kurt Cignetti is a great hire. And he says just wild enough shit to get you to be interested. Like when they asked him at like his first presser of like, how do you feel about the new Big Ten? And he's like, can't wait to win it next year. It's like, okay. Yeah,
like, sure.
Like, but it's also kind of like, you know what? Do you, dude? Like,
whatever. Thought that shit.
Yeah, dude. Like, why not? You know, like, who cares? What are they going to do? Be like, hey, you didn't win it. It's like, no shit, I didn't win it. Like, yeah, what do you want me to do?
Indiana.
Yeah, man. Calm down. So, like, you know, I think he has a really compelling, he has an even more compelling sales pitch than Michigan State, considering, you know, Aiden is going to come in, like we talked about, almost, I want to say guaranteed, but probably would be smart to have him be a three-year starter. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that's a hard sell to any young quarterback as we watch the portal right now, you know, like with quarterbacks just like, yeah, I don't want to wait. And you might not have to, because you could actually go play at a group of five and start as a freshman if you really wanted to, and then transfer to a Big Ten school. You don't have to sit. So it's, right. I don't know, man.
It'll be interesting. I do think that they will add more into that quarterback room. They have to. I mean, it was literally empty before Chiles got there. But that does kind of dovetail nicely into what Jonathan Smith's been able to do on the recruiting trail as it pertains to high school recruits. And while you might look and not be blown away by some of the grades that you see on the players that he's gotten to commit, the fact that Michigan State has 17 commits right now in their 2023 class is incredible. Like, that's remarkable, considering they were at, I think it was down to four when Smith came over. So he did a great job of not only bringing over quite a few of the commits that he had at Oregon State, but also retaining the ones that were committed to Michigan State, and then flipping a handful of others and closing in on some guys that weren't actually committed at OSU, but then ultimately committed to Michigan State. The highlight of his group so far was a guy who actually committed just today in Rustin Young, who's a four-star offensive tackle from Honolulu, not a place Michigan State has dabbled historically, but Rustin Young, checking in at 6'5", 275, is a top 215 player in the country and the number one player in that state. So pretty exciting development there. You love everything about that. It's a four-star offensive tackle from a place that's tough to pull guys from, mm-hmm. and can turn into a pipeline pretty quickly, given how small it is pretty big time. And he's not the only player from Honolulu. Kike Burnett, who is the now third highest rated recruit at Michigan State, an edge defensive edge player, 6'2", 235, a high three-star, is also from Honolulu. I never really thought there would be a Honolulu to East Lansing pipeline, but here we are. And I don't know about you, John, but I'm kind of here for it.
Okay. I'm getting so far ahead of myself.
Yes.
Just stay with me. I really think there's an opportunity to have two homes and away with Hawaii in 4 years as we redo our schedule. I think these guys, their senior year, we got to go out to Honolulu and play, right?
Listen, if I have to, I'll attend.
I must.
It's what I'm willing to do for my team and my school.
Speaking of, Maui's next year. It's coming up on us fast.
Oh, man.
We have to make a couple trips. As offensive linemen go, I don't think I've ever seen a, bad dude come from Hawaii that became a lineman. Maybe I'm just stereotyping, but I feel like they're all dominant.
There's something to, I think I said it last time, I don't mean it. I certainly agree that I don't mean it as a stereotype, but if anything, it's a good stereotype that Polynesian football players are good. They're just big, strong dudes. I mean, Michigan State has a history of
DeMonto Pecco.
The Pecco family, Siltupe Pecco. I mean, there's been a handful of them across the years that came to Michigan State, and they all kind of stood out. I'm sure it's not a universal rule, but this is also, if you're not a fan of West Coast football, this is go up and down the teams on the West Coast. Yep. Go look at USC. Go look at BYU. Look at Utah. Look at Oregon. I mean, these guys tap into this type of pipeline regularly, and it's not surprising because it is closer to Hawaii than East Lansing. But if there's any type of pipeline opening up here, I do think it's one of the probably more underrated talent pipelines that college probably gets overlooked in college football, like the general landscape. People talk about, you hear about Florida and Texas and California, Ohio, justifiably so, but yeah. You look around and see, even Puka Nacua, usually they tend to churn out a lot more linemen, but the Sewells, there's tons of guys in this pipeline. Dude, that it's a really good place to tap in.
So I wonder why Hawaii isn't way better, because
that's a good question.
I get the travel is brutal, to the point where the college football rules have an exception for them to that. If you play Hawaii, you get to play 13 regular season games.
Wow. And
because it's such a, you're traveling so far.
Yeah, it's 7 hours from Phoenix.
Imagine your closest game is in San Jose.
Bro, it's crazy.
So I don't know. Maybe is that enough to deter people from not wanting to play there and instead of playing in the Pac 12 or now defunct? Yeah. I'm speaking out loud. I guess I don't understand why they aren't better,
but I think it's a fair question.
Tommy Chang, remember that dude?
Oh my god. Colt Brennan.
Oh my god.
Dude, they had some guys. Hawaii, when Hawaii is fun, is extremely fun to watch.
June Jones,
dude, had some. So you just have to have somebody embrace the Aloha lifestyle as a head coach.
Oh my god, we were so close to Mike Leach retiring there.
Ugh, RIP. Damn.
He would have, right?
I mean, there could never have been a better fit.
I like the idea of him zooming into away games, because he's I'm not sure.
Coaching 5 games a year, only home games. I would love that personally. Yeah. Damn. What could have been?
Am I writing fanfic? Yes.
Yeah.
Whatever.
See you on Reddit.
If you have an idea for why Hawaii is not better, or maybe they are and I just haven't noticed, let us know, because I'm curious.
They have sick uniforms when they wear
them.
The rainbow throwbacks are some of the absolute best in the sport.
And they do the haka and
Yeah, they're sweet. They're sweet. Okay. Well, listen, we can do all those things at Michigan State too. Keep coming. Rustin, Kike, welcome.
Uh-huh.
Happy to have you. Not the only guys that have been added. I'll kind of make my way down the list here. Let's see here. Who was next? Oh, speaking of quarterbacks earlier, we got ourselves a difficult name to say. One that you will hear screwed up many, many times. A quarterback that I think we're going to see jump up the rankings here flipped from Ball State. He's from Wheaton, Illinois. Alessio.
Oh, yeah.
Milivojevic.
Can I do a quick shout out?
Yes.
Will Hunter threw us his like tape in like
some, months ago.
Yeah. And we were like, all right, first of all, what are you like? Why? Why are you looking at tape of a Mac offer kid? And he's like, dude, I'm telling you, this kid is the truth.
Yep.
And you, I mean, here we are, right? So
yep.
Shout out Will.
Yeah. Big time shout out to Will, because that's how you know that somebody knows ball. A.
That's true.
You can tell, like, I clearly this team it's exciting in a way. Like, I know people probably think, like, wow, we flipped a quarterback from Ball State. I understand the stigma that comes with that sentence. At the same point in time, I'm not trying to besmirch the quarterbacks that just left the program. I hope they're all incredibly successful. Okay. But let's not pretend like they all went to powerhouse schools after they left Michigan State. The best of the three is Sam Levitt going to Arizona State. With the least amount of tape. Caden Hauser went to East Carolina, which we've seen have very good programs in the past. I hope he's very successful. And then we saw Noah Kim go to Coastal Carolina. Again, similar thing. We've seen them be very fun, very good at periods of time. Let's not pretend like any of those teams are
not going to the playoff.
They're not certainly not going to the playoffs. I don't know if any. Yeah. So we can't. What I'm saying is we shouldn't throw stones against a Ball State flip when we remember that Caden Hauser was a Boise State flip. Noah Kim was a Virginia Tech flip. And Levitt was a what? Washington State flip?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's not like we pulled them from these macho programs either.
So that's to say, we hope Jonathan Smith also knows ball.
And yes. We need to know that he knows it at least as well as Will Hunter.
I'd like to think, personally. Otherwise, Will should be making a lot more money.
Agreed.
Anyway, so any others you wanted to go over?
Yeah, I just want to hit on one final theme. Seeing a lot of tight ends and a lot of offensive linemen. We've talked about it many times as it pertains to Mel Tucker's class. It's what you like to see. Two other offensive linemen have committed in the last few days. Peyton Stewart, a 6'7", 270-pound offensive tackle from Kelso, Washington. He's rated as a high three-star. And Rakeem Johnson checking in from Boise, Idaho. 6'3", 255-pound interior offensive lineman. These guys were heavily recruited to Oregon State, in case you can't tell by the West Coast footprint here. But again, both, you know, high-ish three stars, which is it's something you like. And certainly those measurables are a beautiful thing. And then you've also got Wyatt Hook, the 6'5½", 235-pound tight end. So you've gotten a tight end in the transfer portal. You've gotten a tight end in the recruiting class. You've got you've got six offensive linemen in this recruiting class. Rustin Young, the Lunieski twins, Peyton Stewart, and Rakeem Johnson. That's, you love to see that as the focus, and it's not
surprising. You love to see it.
You just do. It's beautiful. So I think we'll put our final touch on recruiting here and just say that expect more action in the transfer portal. I would imagine that class probably gets up I don't know what the final number would be, but I'd have to think it's going to at least double the number that it is now, just to round out the rest of the class. And I wouldn't be surprised to see Michigan State be very, very active with 2024 recruits almost immediately. So exciting stuff. And when I say 2024, of course, I mean 2025. But so far, so good, I think. It's been very encouraging to see what Jonathan Smith has done in terms of roster turnover this thus far.
We are in the honeymoon period. Keep enjoying it. And we'll see where he nets out. Like you said, to go from where they were at with I don't even know how many recruits to working on a top 35 class, that's kind of a miracle.
Yeah, exactly.
That cannot go overlooked. That is Mel Tucker 2020 class levels of challenging. So kudos if we finish strong. Should we take a break and then go talk about a different child?
Indeed. Yeah. All right, here we go. 3, 2, 1. Then we're back. I don't know how to feel. I think I feel good. But this is like the kid finally got an A on a paper, finally followed that up with a nice B+, and you're wondering what might happen the third time. Is it a charm or is it going to be bad?
Well, for me, it's like the Tyler, the Creator, GIF. Okay. Like, what do you want me to tell you? Good job. Like, you, congrats. You
got it.
You did the thing that you should do. Like, and like, we're being hard on him, but at the same time, it's like kind of like the Michigan football situation where they're like, where Harbaugh's like, we've faced so much adversity. It's like, well, it's self-inflicted, man. Like, you created it. Same with MSU basketball. It's like, man, we were backs against the ropes and we overcame. And it's like, well, why were your backs against the ropes? Like, you put yourself there. So I'm impressed considering the product we had seen to date with the Baylor game. But before we get there, I guess I should paint the picture of how we got there. Because since we left, I think we had given a silent treatment. And
yes. Yes, indeed.
I'll quickly go over the games that since we left you. 74-68 loss to Arizona. That loss looks good. And as it continues to age.
Mm-hmm.
86-55 win over Georgia Southern. Okay.
Got it.
I think one thing I wanted to point out here was there was like something that happened that I was like, okay, I'm going to make a note of that and see what happens. Holloman had 10 assists and Fears had 10 rebounds.
Mm.
And Hoggard was fine, but it was kind of like, okay, like you are running out of leash because there are some capable guys behind you. Like there is not a drop off. There might even be like an uptick, and that might be controversial, but we'll get to it. Moving on to the first Big Ten game, home game against Wisconsin, in which they were back and forth for most of the game and then completely fell apart to end it.
Love it.
70-57. It was humiliating. I was embarrassed for the first time in a long time of Michigan State basketball because they got dummied against not a good Wisconsin team, but a tougher one. Like, that's what was so depressing is like they were tougher than us. And like, Wisconsin's not tough, man. That program's not tough. Like, they want to be tough, but those are the floppers, man. So, like, to get out-toughed by the floppers was, like, on your home court in the first Big Ten game where you could have been like, you know what, screw everything that happened already. Like, you know, all that matters is the conference. And you just do that. It was completely disheartening, only to follow it up with almost what became a must conference win game in Lincoln, in which they went toe-to-toe with Nebraska and lost 77-70. And you know, at that point there was a lot of questions of what's next, because losing, going 0-2 in the Big Ten in a year where you were maybe not favored because of Purdue, but certainly top four, and to go 0-2 out of the gate is just completely unacceptable, especially to a Nebraska team that isn't bad, but by far the worst loss that MSU had taken on. And it set the scene for a game at Little Caesars Arena in Detroit against number six undefeated Baylor, in which, you know, you may describe as one that MSU had to have, and a lot of people questioned if they were even capable of competing in a had-to-have it game. So set it up for you from there.
Yeah, it, thanks for giving me the good part.
Of course.
It was – so I'm going to admit something. I missed the beginning of this game.
It's okay.
And when I checked the score, I didn't believe what I was seeing.
Thought it was wrong.
I thought it was wrong because I think it was like, I don't know, it had to be somewhere in the 30 to 10 range or something to that effect. I think it was 36 to 11. And it was with like, or something to that effect. Maybe it was like 22 to 9. I don't remember. It was somewhere in.
It was 36 to 11.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was.
So I missed the beginning, and that maybe it wasn't the first time I saw the score, but when I was about to turn it on, which is, you know, I think 5 or 6 minutes left in the first half, that was the score. And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be the guy that screws this up. So I intentionally did not. And I told you this during the game. I intentionally did not turn the game on. I did my part. OK, I'm the Starship Troopers gif of I'm doing my part for the team. And you're welcome.
It was drop your Venmo. People owe you.
Yeah. Staggering. Michigan State went into the half up 45 to 17, ended up winning 88 to 64 and just dominated the game. I mean, Tyson Walker played out of his mind, 25 points, 5 steals, 4 assists, hit all 4 of his 3s. As a team, MSU went 8 of 12 from deep. Trey Holloman, like you said, built on his strong performance a handful in a row now, hit 2 out of 3 from deep, had 11 points. It was a complete team effort, though. Carson Cooper had 8. Booker had 7. Carr had a handful of huge dunks. You had some real highlight reel moments from him, not for the first time this year, but the windmill obviously was kind of like the cherry on top in this game. But I think what stood out to me more than anything else was that it felt like MSU found or finally listened to our show maybe and agreed to their identity. And that identity is a gritty, strong defensive team that has a lot of especially very good guard depth that can really defend. With limited exception. But when you watch this game, they turned Nunn and Dennis each over 6 times in this game. Baylor had 21 turnovers. Michigan State also had 15, which is really the first time the turnover bug has come up and bit them this year. Yep. They won the rebound. What's that?
It just was not even a factor.
Yeah, wasn't. And then the turnover, Michigan State out-rebounded Baylor by 9 and just looked comfortable, and they put their foot down and kept their foot down, which we have every time they've come close and been like, guys, we're gonna, you know, silence all the haters, da 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 da, they fall apart. This was the exact opposite, and then we'll talk about Oakland, where it just looked like more of the same. But hard to overstate, I think, the importance of this win, because you look at the schedule. This was MSU's last chance at a signature non-conference win when they had, I mean, at least 2 other chances in Duke and Arizona to establish that. And they had already started 0-2 in the conference. I mean, it was getting dire fast. And MSU still has a long ways to go to get back into the race in the conference. Make no mistake. They're currently, like I said, 0-2. The only other 0-2 team is also 6-5 Iowa. And so it's a long way to go. But as you look at if you look at the signs coming out of this game and then Oakland, you wonder if maybe they've started to come, if they can congeal on that identity, then I think, you know, a lot of what they want to accomplish is still in front of them.
Well, long way to go. Like you can do it once, and that's amazing because we know it's in you. I think we all knew it was there. That was the graduation. That was the half step forward from the Marquette win, what you saw there.
Yeah.
So it's in there. I don't think it's realistic to think that that A-plus game comes out every time. Knowing that you can do it is really important. And now the schedule is actually perfect because you have, you know, we'll talk about the Oakland game, but they had a chance to have a lapse. They had a one day turnaround against a team that had 9 days off before. And the most important game for a lot of guys on Oakland's roster schedule. Certainly for Greg Campy, he wants to beat MSU once. Like, seriously, and I don't mean that disrespectfully, but like, I mean, you play someone 20 times, you want to win once, right? I think you had a chance for a letdown and they just didn't do that. They played like a mature team that takes care of things early and never really lets it get close in the second half. You know, it was a good win, you know, in the sense that they did exactly what they were supposed to. And like I was saying, the schedule sets up perfectly because, you know, you have a few days off and then you probably play the worst team or one of the worst teams you'll play all season in Stony Brook. And then you move on to an actually decent test against Indiana State. They are, I'm telling you right now, if you remember before the season started, I told you that you should not overlook James Madison. Mm-hmm. I'm telling you right now that you should not overlook Indiana State. Not the same level of tornado warning, but near. And Michigan State does not have the benefit of overlooking anyone. Like, you are not good enough to, and your record proves it. So this will be a test game. And then you ease into a home game against one of, if not the worst, Big Ten team in Penn State at home. And then you play at Northwestern, which is a very friendly environment as away games go in the Big Ten. So, and then you graduate to at Illinois, which is an actually very difficult environment to play in against a program that is, you know, very respectable and one of the easily the top four teams in the Big Ten. So like it's like a very nice graduated, you know, tests after one after another. And if this team's serious, they'll win all. If they're unserious, they will lose one or more of those. And so it's all in front of them to get back on track.
Yeah, I think this is – and it's funny because I wonder how much our tune changes. And I know you can't do revisionist history, but if they beat James Madison and they beat Nebraska, we're sitting here at 8-3 – with losses to Duke, Wisconsin, and Arizona. Like,
they're still unserious, though, because that is not national championship-level basketball, and they're so far away from that.
Of course, but I think that you've seen – I think you hit on a very important word, and it's a word that I think we were all hoping would apply to this team right off the bat. It was the thing that, quite frankly, we were all expecting because of all of the returning minutes and how – little we'd have to rely on newcomers and how much they would just like provide exciting new toys. And that's maturity. Mm-hmm. I think you saw maturity out of this team and how they came out. And like you said, they got out to leads and they stayed out on those leads. I think the next very big test for them is how they respond when they get down, because they're going to fall behind in some of these games. Their next four, like you said, Stony Brook, Indiana State, Penn State, Northwestern. Like, they're going to fall behind in one of these games, maybe more than they'd like to early on, because they're not I guess I should put it this way. One of two things is going to happen. Either they're going to come out and be adults and take care of all four of these games and make that six games in a row of them doing that, which would be the ideal outcome. And I think at that point, we start having larger conversations once more. That's not the likely outcome. The likely outcome is that they you know, do that in a couple of these. But ultimately, they maybe struggle in the first half, or maybe one of these teams puts together a nice little second half run and they have to respond to adversity. We have not seen them successfully do that throughout the course of this season. Every time that's presented itself, Duke, they fought, you and I saw in person, scrapped and clawed to get back in it, ultimately fell up short. James Madison, kind of the same thing, quite honestly. Arizona, they were right in it until the very end, made a bunch of second half runs, came up short. Wisconsin fell apart at the end. Nebraska fell apart towards the end. That is going to be the thing that has to change. And maturity and being adults is the only way that that's going to happen. So I like what you're saying. I think these next four games give them a real chance to get that confidence up before they go to Illinois. And that's a real test. And then after that, you've got Rutgers and Minnesota at home. Again, two, at least on paper, winnable games. So the path to being a decent seed in the NCAA tournament is still there. The path to, you know, being relevant and competing and achieving things like they did last year is still there. But these two games, I think, it's not to say they were make and break for the entire season, but like if you lose to Baylor, you're under 500. Mm-hmm. That's 10 games into the season. That's unacceptable at a Michigan State program. Instead, we're very lucky. Blew out a top 10 team. That's a huge resume builder if you're anywhere close to the bubble. So all in all, you got to be pretty happy with what you saw over the last couple, week or so.
Yeah, we're doom and gloom, but I will note that, you know, despite the 5-5 record or 4-5 going into that game, the metrics, the KenPoms, the Torvics, the Mayas, they loved Michigan State. You know, you look back at the losses, they are not bad and they didn't get blown out. And, right. You know, despite not having any good wins, that matters metric wise. So they weren't certainly not good, but they weren't bad. And, you know, as we saw with Baylor, maybe there was a bit of regression to the mean or the opposite. So it was always right there. But back to the point about, like you said, what if they were 8-3? I mean, to me, I'm at a point in my life where if you're not competing for a national championship, like it doesn't matter. And, you know, I think Tom Izzo is at that point. And so I don't think it matters whether they won those games or lost those games. It was always a matter to me of like, can you get up to becoming a Final Four contender? And then everything is, you know, up in the air. They were running out of runway to do that. And they absolutely did the exact thing you had to do against Baylor to do that. And, you know, now here we are, regardless of record, you know, hopefully seeing the runway toward getting toward becoming a Final Four caliber team. Long ways to go. But, you know, it's there for the taking. It's going to be a grind.
And, John, credit to you because you made it to 4-5 feeling that way. And I didn't even make it there.
It's okay.
I wasn't out after JMU. I wasn't out after Duke. I wasn't out after Arizona. I really think that Nebraska really was kind of the one where I was like, okay, yeah. I don't have to watch this game in real time. I'll watch it recorded because like it's Nebraska. I know we're not going to lose to Nebraska. And then that happens. And I'm like, wow, this might be like, I might just tune out. Like, I might just not have time.
Yeah.
Like, the difference between basketball and football is so vast because football's only 12 games. Even in the worst of years, I'm tuning in for at least the majority until things get really out of hand, right? Mm-hmm. And because it's only so much. You only get so much. Basketball, it's just – there's so much more time to make mistakes in a basketball game. And when it's ugly, it's so
bad.
Awful. And yeah. – I think I'm back to the point now where I'm ready and willing to go all the way back in if they give me a reason to, which is the most dangerous and vulnerable place to be as a fan.
You know, I'll manage to throw in a positive to MSU and a knock on Michigan here.
Oh.
Yeah, I think it is hard to watch. Do not get me wrong. I think you watched, you know, it's cliche, but Tom Izzo had his team get back to, you know, the roots of Michigan State basketball. Well, it's not a cliche. They did that. And they're like, it's not a coincidence that doing that wins you basketball games.
Yeah.
This team, for whatever reason, continued to think that they could roll the balls out and hoop with the talent of the other teams. And they have, Michigan State has a lot of, they have a lot of above replacement level talent. They have one good player. And when you're playing against teams that have, you know, maybe six above replacement level players, but two to three good players, that's better. And you got to change your tactic. You got to stop going against the Izzo-isms. You have to, like, as a team, decide that you are going to play together as on defense and rebound together. You have to make a conscious choice on offense to play to your strengths and not force it. And they finally did that, and it all started to work out. I mean, basketball, it's such a simple thing, right? Mm-hmm. Tom simplifies it. Play defense, rebound, take good shots. You win games. And they did it, and I think they're not that far away, because when the knock on Michigan, as I'm just going to say, is I just watched them play Florida. Lost in double overtime. I've seen that high school basketball game 100 times. That was a class A regional final. Teams aren't even good. They're athletic. They get up and down. It was fun, but there was no one had a clue. No one had a clue about basketball. They were playing. They were running up and down, and it was entertaining, but no one was playing the sport, you know, with sets, with thought, with, you know, strategically. And you don't win games doing that unless you have NBA talent, and neither of those teams do. So what I'm getting at here is Michigan State is still bought in on Tom Izzo. That's huge, because we already know they don't have the talent to roll the balls out and win games, because they simply don't have enough NBA players. Yep. So they're still bought in. They can win this way. There's a path forward. And they're a few wins away from us considering talking to our son again.
Yeah, we're thinking about it. And listen, to add on to your point, if you feel bad about Michigan State 6-5, just look at Michigan's 6-6.
Mm-hmm.
Their losses are to Long Beach State, mm-hmm. Memphis, Texas Tech, Oregon, Indiana, and Florida. I'm not sure how many of those teams are making in March. I'll be totally honest with you.
Not many. Maybe none.
Potentially none. Be a real shame. Oh, also, shout out to Tyson Walker. Tyson Walker got his 1,000th point on a pretty vintage Tyson Walker little fadeaway from the baseline, getting fouled. You know, you don't know what's going to happen this year, so you don't want to say necessarily that it is low-key, but, like, guy was a transfer from Northeastern, came to Michigan State, and has scored 1,000 points in less than 3 years of basketball. Shout out Tyson Walker.
I want to expound on that just for a minute. He's 54th all-time in Michigan State history, like, already. That is
good.
He is going to pass a lot of people. In the next four games, he will pass Joey Hauser, Miles Bridges, Magic Johnson, Jumpin' Johnny Green, and Goran Suton.
Jeez, wow. A lot of names that are very recognizable in that group.
It keeps going. Like, I'm going to continue to update you guys as we go. And, like, it's going to be the names. Like, you know them, man. And he's done it in – I mean, you heard Magic. You heard – in there, like, they didn't all play 4 years, but Gary Harris was in there. It doesn't matter. They're the dudes, right? So he is solidifying himself as a Spartan, not a great, but, like, certainly we have entered Aaron Henry territory and even beyond, right?
He's a Spartan good.
He's a Spartan good, and with potential for more.
Yeah. I will say that I love that you said early on in the season, like, when he plays hero ball, it's not how this team's going to win. But I do love seeing his usage. Like, this guy needs to shoot the ball 15 to 16 times a night, and he gets those shots most of the time. He's been back to being red hot from three.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's hard to get mad about him. He's averaging 20 points a game, shooting almost 50% from the field.
You're right, man. Shame on me for I'm gonna pat myself on the back for one thing and shun myself for the other. Beginning of the season in our preview pod, I said, I don't know how much more you can expect to squeeze out of Tyson Walker production-wise, because he's limited as from a size perspective, and there's only so many like percentage points you can increase from a three-point shooting perspective. That was with the assumption as well that everybody on the other team wouldn't show up and be dog shit for the first 10 games. That said, he has certainly asserted himself. And when I say he can't play hero ball, it's because when I say that, it's like when he against teams would be like, you know what? No one else is really here. No one's doing anything. AJ Hogard isn't here with me. Malik Hall isn't here with me. Matty Sissoko can't score. I can't rely on the freshman. Akins is a no-show. I'm going to have to do it myself. Well, he can win playing hero ball under the assumption that everybody else has at least played an average game or maybe slightly below average. You can win those games. But he was playing hero ball because he had to against teams because nobody else showed up. And like, that's just not sustainable. Like, there are very few players in the country that can win games when that happens. So he's a lot more special than we ever could have dreamed. And like you said, he's going to keep flying up the chart here. One more stat I'll keep track for you. 114 3-pointers made. He's going to crack into the top 10 soon, I think, with Jarrell Summers at 161. So a little bit to go, but I think he'll crack in there. And that's a very good list.
Yeah. Shout out to Tyson. We'll wrap this up here, but yeah, it's hard not to, as long as it is the one thing about this team. It's like, if you have him, you've got a puncher's chance, but the rest of this team, if they want to accomplish what they need to and should accomplish, quite honestly, they're all going to have to sort of catch up. And I think we're starting to see some signs of that. But like you said, handful of winnable games coming up here. Our hearts are there. They're ready to be given. It's up to them to come take them.
And could be in for a fun ride because the Big Ten is wide open this year.
Wide open. All right, guys. That's about it. Sorry for the terrible intro. Hope you guys found the content enjoyable. We love you. We probably won't come to you again until the new year. So enjoy the football. Roll Tide. For John, this has been Austin. We'll catch you guys later.
See
you. You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.